Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Casino City Gang, your podcast for all things gambling. I am Vin Narayanan, Casino City's managing editor, and I'm joined, as always, by Casino City's senior editor, Aaron Todd. Greetings, Aaron.
How you doing, Vin?
I'm good. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. I'm just seeing here now, though, that the Celtics are the vast underdog to win the NBA title. The Spurs, if the current odds are Spurs at minus 110, Heat at plus 110, Oklahoma City at plus 1,000, and Celtics at plus 5,000.
Yeah, that's a lot. And it's odd because you generally don't see odds that high, because who wants to cover a plus 5,000 bet?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, the Celtics lost two games on the road. You have to win a road game if you're in their situation, but...
And theoretically, and I just say this, theoretically, an NBA series doesn't begin until a home team loses a game.
Thank you, Michael Wilbon.
What? I didn't even know I was channeling Michael Wilbon. It's an old sports reporter trope, of which I was one. So I used to be a sports reporter, so these are sports reporter tropes that you just spit out. I did hear a stat recently, and who knows what this stat means, but apparently teams that go down 2-0 win series in the NBA 6% of the time.
Well, then the plus 5,000 isn't looking as good as I thought it was.
and so there is that. And so there's that aspect as well. And so we'll see what happens. I'm more a believer in the old sports reporter trope that an NBA series doesn't win until a home team loses a game. Than I am in the 6% number.
Well, I'll be honest. Looking at those numbers, I wouldn't pick any of them. None of those look like attractive bets to me. But anyway,
what's the number in the Heat and what's the number in the Spurs?
Heat's plus 110. Spurs are minus 110.
Spurs.
I think the best value is probably Oklahoma City at plus 1,000.
That's great value.
But it's not great value. It's the best value on the board.
Well, it's the best value on the board. It's
you're saying 10-1. It's only 10-1.
It's really good value.
They're down 2-0, though.
It doesn't matter. They're down 2-0. A series doesn't start until home team loses the first game.
I think you may have lost me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, I can't hear you. But that's okay, because I'm next to you, so I can hear what you're saying anyway. So.
All right. We'll presume this is going to work, or you can call in again. Let's try having you call in again. Okay. Talking about the World Series of Poker, but more specifically, the heads-up tournaments of the World Series of Poker, and whether we need to re-examine how they're being set up. The World Series of Poker kicked off this week. They're in event number 3, which is a $3,000 buy-in heads-up no limit, hold'em pot limit Omaha event. Now, there's a mouthful.
Started on Tuesday. Actually, this looks like the type of tournament I'd like to play in.
It started on Tuesday, but not everyone had a first-round
match. Please explain.
Well, they ended up allowing, I believe the number was 312 players to enter the event. I'm just opening up the 317 players entered the event. Now, if you're running a bracket event, you know that you have to have something that is, 2 raised to the X power. 317 fails on a number of accounts. It's not even an even number. So, so clearly you're going to have some people that have some buys. That to me just seems really unfair. They should have capped it at 256. Had the first 256 people that signed up start, and then I'm sorry, but the next however many it is, 50, 60, the next 65. Sorry, you're out of luck. You didn't sign up on time.
Now, poker is in part a game of chance. It's a gamble. When you sign up to play poker tournament, isn't this part of the gamble you're taking that some people will get a first round buy and some people won't?
No, you're taking a gamble that you're going to be treated the same as everybody else is treated in the tournament. You're going to get different cards, but you're going to play under the same rules. You're going to have to beat the same number of people. I don't think it's fair to somebody to say, okay, no, you have an extra match. just because of the random luck of the draw. It doesn't make any sense to me. yes, you know, there's luck involved in poker tournaments in terms of where you're seated, who you're matched up against, if you're at a table full of, you know, absolute newcomers to the game or a table full of, you know, ridiculous pros. That it gets taken into account, but I don't think that you can have luck of the draw mean, oh, you know what, I get to win, I only have to win one fewer match to win this tournament than someone else. That's not fair to me.
And
it's the tournament has what are now called the first round games, which everybody else in the world knows are play-in games. So that's what that is, you know, they have the first, four, so there are 8 teams have to play those games. There's a total of 68 teams now in the tournament, in the NCAA bracket, for the Division I men's basketball tournament. But those are there as a result of, if you're one of the best teams, you're not going to be in that situation. Should we be seeding players in a heads-up poker tournament and give them buys? Well, like, this just isn't fair.
I mean, to me, this is the interesting thing, though, is the NCAA tournament has clearly found a way into it, which is you've got a series of play-in games and you get into the main field.
You also have a regular season and conference tournaments which determine your entry.
Well, here's my question for you. Rather than first-round buys, shouldn't it be if you register after the 128 mark, or if you register after the 256 mark, all the players that register beyond that get thrown into a play-in field?
So the problem is that they want to make it possible to register late. So what would you do? Have everyone who plays in that first 256, those are second-round games?
Yeah,
it's second round tournament.
You reward,
but you can't. But the problem is, okay. So say there's 257. So then you've got 256 people. You've got to pull one of those 256 and say, okay, well, one of you is going to have to play an extra match, even though.
Well, you signed
up on time.
No, and I get it. So maybe the cutoff point isn't the 256 mark. Maybe
it's 128.
It's 128. Or maybe it's not even 128. Maybe it is 248, or whatever you have to do.
It's still got to be 2 raised to the x power, because that's how many people you would need in the second round.
So it's 128. The cutoff point's 128, and then everyone else is playing a play-in game to get into the field.
Well, that actually still doesn't work, though, because if it's 128 and then you've got 4 people, then you've got – okay, so you've got the 128. It gets down to 64. Where do you put the four new people that were the extra 8?
Look, my point is there's a way – look, math is not my strong suit. There is a way to work this out where you say, all right, this is the set number of people who are guaranteed a spot in the second round, and the rest of you have to play your way into that second round.
So say they say, okay, we're going to have a 100. Say we've got a 128 field of, you want a field of 128, or whatever. So then you say, okay, well, we're going to have the first 100 guaranteed buys, and then the next 56 that get in will have to play an additional first round game. Well, say then
that way there is a reward for registering on time and registering early.
Okay, well, say they then get 57, or say they then get 42, and the number's not equal. Or say they get an odd number, then you've got a situation where you're screwed again.
Well, no, I understand that.
You just need to cap it. You just need to say we're going to have 128, we're going to have 256, or we're going to have 512. When we hit 128, we'll start those matches. If we get 128 more people by the time late registration ends, we'll start those 128.
Yeah.
If we don't, sorry. You're SOL, but it's your own damn fault for not signing up early.
And I get that. I'm just I think philosophically, I agree with you. What I'm trying to look at is there a way to run this tournament and not leave extra money on the table? Because the jump from 128 to 256 isn't that big a deal. The jump from 256 to 512 is a big deal.
Yeah, that's never – I mean, you're just not going to get that many people on a heads-up tournament.
Heads-up tournament. I mean, that's the huge deal. And so the question becomes, do you just cap heads-up tournaments at 256 and understand that, or do you try and create a system where you can accommodate more people that want to play, but and you know you're going to get more than 256 that want to play, but understanding you're never going to get to the 512 mark. And to me, that's the question, is whether that compromise can be reached. And also with the understanding that if you sign up on time, then, yeah, you shouldn't have to play an extra game that maybe people that sign up late do.
What they need to do is to start doing six-person pools and do five heads-up round-robin heads-ups. It'll be like, you know, the first preliminary round qualifications for the World Cup.
Well, for the World Cup?
Yeah. But they have four, though. They only play three games, right?
Yeah. So you create a pod or you create a pool and you go round robin, and then you advance to a knockout stage. I kind of like that, actually.
And that way you can have unequal, unequal distribution. So you could have some pools with four people, some pools with five. So you set it up so you've got 64 pools. Some of them will have four, some of them will have five. And then the 64 winners, and you'll have to have.
Or you take two from each group.
Yeah, the problem is that you're still going to end up some situations. Say you've got a four person group, so everyone's got three matches. You're going to have a lot of those that end up as, you know, three people at 1-1.
Yeah, then you get a playoff. It's heads up.
Then what do? They play three handed or four handed to see who wins?
No, you
high card it for the winner. Well, you know, you say you have to accept a certain amount of luck in poker tournaments.
Well, absolutely, but here's the thing: it's just, you know, maybe
Chinese poker
for the winner. You know, maybe there's a time element. But I like the direction you're going is into the pools or the pods. I think that's a more equitable solution. It allows you to accommodate a larger field without creating the inequities that you see in this system.
The problem is that it would just be so time intensive and staff intensive. I don't think you could. I mean, it could be pulled off. I just don't know how they would do it profitably.
Yeah, so no, and that I get. It's one of those things where I'm finding myself having a hard time getting exercised about it because I understand what you're saying in terms of the players aren't being treated equally, and I get that. But on the other hand, to me, that's part of the gamble in playing a tournament like this. You know, when you go in, that there's a chance you're going to get a buy or not get a buy, and that's part of the risk you assume when you take this tournament. It would be nice to see the World Series come up with a better solution, or anyone running a heads-up tournament come up with a better solution. And ideally, you're right. It should be capped. It should be capped at 128, or it should be capped at 256, or 512. It should be the logical jumps. And when it comes down to like a $10,000 buy-in, I would be more annoyed than buy-ins at the lower level, so like at the $3,500 level or the $3,000 level, which is still a lot of money. But if you're at the $10,000 level and there were 244 entries, which means you don't even get to the 256 mark, I mean, there's lots of first-round buys, or, you know, maybe there's 202 entries. But whatever the number is there, I would be much more exercised than about the $3,000 buy-in thing.
But I don't know. I just know that I would be really pissed if I were in the $3,000, if I plunked down $3,000 and I found out that, oh, you know, half the field doesn't have to play a first-round match, and I do.
Yes.
So I need to get through an extra match to cash. I need to get through an extra match to win the whole thing. And heads up, you know, it's a high variance game. You're talking about a lot of 60-40 hands where, you know, you've got to get through like four more 60-40 situations than someone else. That hardly seems fair.
Well, if let's take the concept of seeding people. So I'm not sure how much of a viable concept it is, but it sounds intriguing in that there are tournaments all over the place where people are seeded and the top seeds get buys. Is there a viable seeding system out there for a heads-up tournament?
Again, you know, because you talk about poker being a game where you have to accept some sort of luck being part of it, I don't think that there is. I mean, you could do the, for instance, the Global Poker Index. You could use that information to try and do some seeding. I know that, you know, for I think Poker News did that this year when the NCAA basketball bracket came out. They decided to do a poker bracket with the top 64 from the Global Poker Index. And they, those were just like fan voting. They got to pick who they thought, you know, would advance from that group. So, I mean, yeah, that could be possible. You could do that. But the problem is, like, you know, the Global Poker Index, if I want to plunk down $3,000 for the Heads Up No Limit Hold'em Pot Limit Omaha event, last I checked, I don't have any points on the Global Poker Index. So I would be unranked. And
yes,
there would be a lot of other people that are unranked.
Which
so how would we
for you.
No, but how would you seed all of the
It's just like tennis, though. I mean, I could be the greatest tennis player in the world. I go play at the U.S. Open. I'm going to go play unranked. And I have to qualify and make my way through it. Why should it be any different for you at the World Series
of
Poker?
I'm not saying it should be any different than me. I'm just saying that there would be dozens, if not hundreds, of people in my situation.
Well, yeah, there would be lots of people unranked, and there would be lots of ranked players, and the ranked players would get the buys, and the unranked players wouldn't get the buys.
Yeah, then I'm not playing that event. And so,
but that's
so
your choice.
And so aren't hundreds and hundreds of others who may.
But there are lots of lots of tennis tournaments where first top ranked players get buys into the
second
round.
Yeah, and those players don't have to plunk down $3,000 to try and play.
They got to plunk down some sort of cash to try and play. I mean, they've got to pay some sort of entry fee.
I doubt it's $3,000.
I mean, whatever it is, they're flying to Qatar. And putting themselves up in a hotel room.
As are the people who are buying into the
World Series of Poker. So, yeah. And then they're paying some sort of entry fee, and they don't necessarily have a hope of reclaiming it. It's – I don't know. To me, it's the risk of a heads-up tournament. And if you're going to play in it, you know what you're getting yourself into.
The entry fee for the U.S. Open is $125.
Yes. Yeah, I'm guessing for ATP Tour events, it's probably higher.
This is the U.S. Open.
Yeah, but the U.S. Open is different. It's like the U.S. Open in golf. It's supposed to be a democratic.
No, the difference is that in tennis, there's a lot of sponsorship money that contributes to the prize pool. The players aren't contributing to the prize pool.
No, I get that.
The players are contributing to players are paying the rake.
Yes.
So they're paying the administration fee. They don't have to contribute to the prize pool, whereas, you know, poker players have to pay the rake and the prize pool.
Look, I get the analogy is imperfect, but that doesn't change the fact that the system still works. I mean, the system is, all right, you're an unseeded player. If you want it to be a seeded player and get a bye, you should have played in more tournaments leading up to it. And
But the whole ethos behind the World Series of Poker is that anyone can win. I don't think that's the whole ethos behind the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament.
No, it's not. But the whole ethos behind the World Series of Poker is, yeah, for certain events, anyone can win.
For any event, anyone can win.
So
any random Chris Moneymaker walking in off the street can win any single event. Is it likely to happen? No. But it can.
It can, and which is fine. But it's just, look, the million-dollar buy-in – look, buy-ins by nature become self-selecting. So the idea that any schlub can win, no. You've got to raise the money. You've got to do all sorts of things in order to get into that buy-in event and win. So the idea that this is a completely democratic process is ridiculous. This is a process that's open to people who have the means to play in it. So I'm not buying the whole ethos that any player can win. Any player that with means can win.
Well, that's given.
Yeah, and so the question you have to determine is, if you have the means, do you want to play in the tournament given that set of information? And that's why I don't have a problem with the seeding. It's just why I really don't have a problem with the way they're operating the heads-up tournament now, in the sense that ideally you are correct. It would be capped at 128 or 256 or 512. Those would be your three field sizes, or 64. I mean, those would be your various field sizes. But every player signing up for the event knows what they're getting into. And for them to be pissed off about all these first-round buys when they knew what they were signing up for seems it just doesn't ring true.
I know, I don't, you know, and that's the thing. I haven't seen anyone pissed off about it. I think I'm the only one. So I haven't seen anyone complain about it at all. So I don't know. I just know that if I had entered that event, I would have done so with the understanding that it was going to be a perfect bracket, that there wouldn't have been buys. Even if I had entered that event and had been given a buy, I wouldn't have felt good about it. As most people were given buys, because 317, so you've got, what, about 100, 256, so 100 and 50, 61, there are 120 people, 122 people who did not have buys. And therefore, about 195 people who did.
Yeah.
So most people got buys. Not, you know, a huge majority, but a pretty big number got buys. So odds are you got one. And if you didn't, I'd be pissed about it.
Yeah, and I get that. If you didn't get a buy, you'd be pissed, and you're knocked out of the tournament in the first and when a bunch of people who didn't play are already one step closer to winning.
I'll tell you
when
I get really
did.
Pissed about it. After I'd won three matches and wasn't in the money and had to win a fourth, and everybody else only had to win three matches, that's when I'd be pissed about it.
Yeah, I get that. I understand why you would be pissed about it. Because, yes, winning one more match than everyone else sucks. But when that's when you signed up for, when you know that's what you signed up for, then you've lost the right to complain. It's sort of where I stand. But philosophically, I agree with you. I think that the fair thing to do would be to cap it. You cap it at 128 or you cap it at 256. Well, cap is the wrong word. The correct thing to do is you either have a field size of 128 or you have a field size of 256 or you have a field size of 512. I mean, that's what you have to do. There can't be in between. That is the most fair thing to do.
Thank you for finally admitting the truth.
No, I admitted that a long time ago. I'm just saying your sense of outrage on behalf of the players playing was misplaced.
Well, and here's the crazy thing, actually.
Just ignore that point.
No. I'm just looking at the structure now. So here's the thing. They ended up paying out 64 places. If they'd only had 256, they probably only would have paid 32. So I actually be pissed if I got a bye and won two matches, or even actually more appropriately if I won three, because the payouts were really low. You put in $3,000. If you finished 33rd through 64th, you got $3,395. You netted $395. If you win one more match and then finish from 17th to 32nd, you got $5,144. Most of the time when you cash, you win close to, if not double, your buy-in. But because they changed it so that people who did win three matches who did not get a buy would still cash, you have 32 places, paid about $3,400. That's $100,000 from the prize pool that's not being distributed upwardly to the top 32. That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, and I don't disagree that it's a lot of money. The point isn't it's a lot of money. The point is you know what you sign up for. This is the way these are the rules under which the Heads Up tournament is being run. Look, I have the same problem with late registration. I think late registration is stupid, just like the Heads Up thing I think should be a perfect bracket size. So I agree with you philosophically. I just can't work up a sense of outrage over this. But I can work up a sense of outrage.
You're not trying hard enough.
But I can work up a sense of outrage over late registration. So, you know, maybe, different sorts for different folks. All right. Let's end this conversation here because it's going nowhere. And let us move on to another interesting topic because I found it was interesting. And Aaron, you pulled this story, pointed the story out yesterday to me. William Hill is offering It was basically giving a 5-pound wager for free to parents of kids who play soccer. And they're saying, if your kid and if your kid wins, I mean, not wins, but if your kid makes the English national team, or for men's or women's soccer team, if they make the national team, we're going to pay off this bet at 1,000 to 1.
So it's basically a free £5,000 if your kid
makes the national team. That's pretty cool. That's very cool. And so my question, and the way they're doing it is they're actually giving these bet certificates. You don't have to go into a William Hill shop and say, here, give me the bet certificate. They're actually the betting ticket. They're actually giving these to parents of kids who are to kids who have people playing these games in organized leagues and that sort of thing. So it's a nice thing to do. But Aaron, you and I were trying to figure out what the American equivalent of this would be, and we didn't do a very good job of it, did we?
I don't know if there is one. I mean, you know, really, there's no sport that Americans are as passionate about as, you know, people in England are about soccer, except maybe
football.
NFL football. But there's no U.S. national football team. I mean, it just doesn't exist. If we were to play in the Olympics, it would be – if it were an Olympic sport,
I mean, what
would happen? I mean, it would who would possibly compete? Maybe,
well,
Samoa would be able to put together a decent team of linemen.
Maybe it's if your kid makes the Pro Bowl.
Yeah, but no one cares about the Pro Bowl.
You would now.
Yeah, right now Zach Diassi's wishing he had one of those tickets. But anyway, I just don't see that there's an American equivalent. So I went beyond that, and you mentioned, you know, maybe the Olympic basketball team, you know, the dream team. And I thought, you know, yeah, maybe, because if you look at the English national team, it is made up of professionals. It's the same way that the U.S. dream team in basketball is now. And I don't know if you can call it a dream team anymore.
No,
but let
us put the dream team moniker to bed.
But anyway, you know, the U.S. Olympic basketball team is such a small squad. And to be perfectly honest, if your kid's making the U.S. Olympic basketball team, you aren't worried about collecting a 5,000-pound bet ticket. Football is in England, soccer players in England, they're paid pretty well.
So they're not worried
about it. But I don't think they're paid quite at the level as
– Oh, they're paid more.
Are you sure?
Yeah, they make absurd amounts of money.
Yeah, no, the really, really good ones. But
those are the ones that end up on the national team.
Yeah, but not all of them. It's a much bigger team. There's like 25, 26 guys, right?
Yeah, but they play in like all over the world for different teams and different clubs, and they all get paid absurd amounts of money.
This is why soccer is never going to take off in America, because you can't – it's too confusing. Wait, they brought over that what's-his-name guy, the Bendit guy. He was playing for a different team, and they missed games because he had to go play for somebody else. You never saw Joe Montana miss a game because he's like, oh, yeah, I got an arena game. I got to go to play in the Arena Football League. Sorry, I got to miss my start for the 49ers. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense at all.
You are so wrong. It's not even funny.
How can you play for four different teams at the same time?
You don't play for four different teams at the same time. David Beckham plays for two teams. He plays for the English national team, and he plays for whatever club team that he's playing for. So in this,
and then he played for the Galaxy.
No, that was his club team. Once he joined the Galaxy, that was his club team.
Well, then why was he leaving to go play for the England? Then he shouldn't be able to go play for England. They're paying a salary.
You play for a club team and you play for your national team. Those are your two requirements. The NBA players do it. NHL players do it. The
league takes a break, though.
Well, no, the league doesn't take a break. Not always. But the difference is the NBA seasons and the NHL seasons tend to coincide. So it works out a little better. Now, the NHL does take a break for the Olympics. And they have historically. They're considering not taking that break now. And then the World Championships go on, and as teams get eliminated from the Stanley Cup, those players go and join their national teams. So it's a little different system. But the other problem is that, and this is tough, is that the European soccer season, you generally aren't playing qualifiers, World Cup qualifiers during the soccer season, whereas the American soccer season
it's not the same as the European soccer season. If you take a look at the European soccer season, it starts from September and goes until April, and then the qualifiers are played during the summer. It's playing. I mean, you occasionally miss time, but you don't miss as much time as you do because of the American soccer season. Because the American soccer season is different, and it's played primarily during when all these qualifying matches are happening. So the impact is a lot higher in the season. But that said, yes, they miss a couple of games here or there, but that's okay. It's players miss games all the time. In the NBA, they miss players all the time. You know, a player misses a game because he's got to go to graduation. That's happened before. Player misses time because his wife's having a baby. That happens. It's okay for them to miss a game or two here or there because it's the nature of things.
But he's not missing a game because he has to go shoot for another team to help his wife have the baby. It's because his wife's having a baby. Those are not comparable things. He's going to do the same job for someone else instead of doing it for the people
he's
paying.
He's not going to do the same job for someone else. No, going to play for your national team is not the same as going to play for someone else. It's got nothing to do with that. It's
the same thing. He's going to use the same skills to do the same exact actions as he would be doing for you for the job that you are paying him for, which he is shirking, to go and do something else.
But you want
to
know what? As the club, you are making money off of this guy being on the national team. It raises the profile of your club. It raises the profile of his jersey sales. It increases jersey sales. All the ancillary income that comes out of that, it just goes up. The value of that player goes up by his appearance on the national team because people care more about it.
It helped the LA Galaxy that David Beckham went and played for a team that's not in this country. That's not this country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's part of what makes Beckham great.
It made the MLS look like a bunch of chumps.
No, it didn't.
Yeah, it did to me. He
went and
even
played
tried.
For the British national team. He did not go and play for a club team in England. It's not like he went and played for Manchester United.
How did we get sidetracked on this ridiculous conversation?
Oh, boy.
You're never going to convert me to a soccer fan. You just really aren't.
Well, I've got so many things to convert you. We got Euro 2012 coming up, and we got to make our
best. We aren't in Europe.
It doesn't matter. It's one of the best betting events in the world. Betting is betting. Look, you and I both know a certain individual that bet on an American living in Las Vegas who bet on Japan to beat the U.S. in the Women's World Cup final.
Yes.
All right. So this
that's different, though. How is he's making a bet. That's fine. Whatever. But that's
all right.
And that was a game that at least that had America in it. Last I checked, Euro 2012 is not going to have America in it.
No, but it is a fine sporting event that provides
for those who care,
which provides great wagering opportunities. You, as a person who once tried to pick every cricket game, should appreciate this.
And
the
I
World
was
Cup
profitable in that endeavor.
Yes, and so you should appreciate great wagering opportunities. So now let us circle back to, is there an American equivalent of this? Can there be?
I think it should be, is your kid going to be the World Series of Poker main event champion?
Oh, good grief. There isn't a parent out there who would want that bet. You'd hand them the $5.
Are you kidding me?
There are very few parents that sit there and
dream. If someone handed that to me and you told me that one of my kids was going to go out and win $10 million.
No, that's not what they're going to say.
World Series main event champ?
Yeah, no. If one of you handed you a $5 bet and said, here, we'll give you $5,000 if your kid becomes the World Series of Poker main event champ. You are going to be in the distinct minority of parents that look at this certificate and say, woohoo!
Hey. If my kids decide that they want to win, if my kids decide and are successful in winning the World Series of Poker main event championship, I will be I'll be all for it.
Yes, look, yes, I don't disagree with that notion.
My mother-in-law's heart is breaking right now. By the way,
that was my larger point. All right, so let us move on from this interesting William Hill event to which we decided there really is no American equivalent.
we had another. Oh, yes, casino saturation, the third topic, and this will be a more serious topic. We will put aside the silliness for a moment. Casinos are popping up everywhere. You had a casino open up in Cleveland. You have another one open up just down the road in Toledo. Toledo, of course, being not far from Cleveland and also an hour outside of Detroit. You have another one going into Columbus. This joins casinos in Indiana. You have casinos open up in Maryland. Big casino Maryland Live getting ready to open up or will be opening up soon. And so you've got that. And in addition to Maryland, there, Caesars wants to build a casino in Baltimore, in the inner harbor there, and their proposals for a waterfront casino in Maryland, just outside of the Washington D.C. metropolitan area, and the head of the Maryland Live Casino said at a recent gaming convention in Atlantic City, he said, "Hey, wait a minute. Casinos aren't like Starbucks. You can't put one on every corner. Otherwise, it's going to start hurting the market." Of course, he wants to keep Caesars out of Baltimore, which would be in direct competition with his casino. And of course, Caesars, Las Vegas Sands said they didn't come into Massachusetts because they thought three casinos in Massachusetts would be too much, along with a slots hall, and there would be casino saturation there. It didn't make sense for them to compete. I, of course, say it had nothing to do with that. They knew they weren't going to get a license, so they didn't want to. So this was a convenient excuse for them not to compete for a license in Massachusetts. But do these people have a point? Do you look at a point and say at some point, wait a minute, why do we need another casino in this region? What are we doing here?
It depends on what you're trying to build. Are you trying to build a whole generation or a whole army of Foxwoods Resort casinos, which are enormous, huge behemoths, or do you want to build reasonably sized casinos that can serve, a couple thousand patrons at a time? I think the market is not really, you can't really fit many more huge resorts. It's at least not in the Northeast. But I can tell you that if you open up a casino in Massachusetts, when the casinos open up in Massachusetts, whenever that might be, when New Hampshire ever manages to pass legislation and if they decide that they're going to open a casino or two, I think that they'll succeed. I think they just have to manage their expectations. I don't think you can have a Mohegan Sun and a Foxwoods and, you can't have three huge resorts in Massachusetts. It'd be too much. I think you can have one pretty big one, and you can have two decent-sized ones, but I don't think you're going to have like humongous, crazy.
Well, let's be fair. There are very few casinos on the scale of Foxwoods.
Well, that's the point. Yeah. I mean, people. The problem is, I think that people, especially in the Northeast, and you're looking at especially in, I'm taking it local, Massachusetts, they saw so much traffic going down south to Connecticut. I said, we want to capture all that, so we need to compete with the same type of place. And
that's
been the thought, and I think that's been the fear of people who are opposed to the idea of opening up, regulated casinos and licensed casinos in Massachusetts, because they don't want to see that type of place open. But if you look at places like, in Philadelphia, I haven't actually seen them, but they aren't. You're not talking about humongous. I mean, they're big.
And they're getting bigger. That's the thing. They're big and they're getting bigger.
You look at Atlantic City. Some of the casinos on the boardwalk are not actually that huge. Some of them are big, but they're not.
But it's, the same is true in Vegas. If you take a look at property like Wynn, the Wynn isn't a Foxwoods size property. It's a fairly small property when it comes right down to it in terms of size of the gaming floor and number of machines out there. It's not huge. It's not small, but it's not gigantic. If you take a look at something like the Rio gaming floor isn't that big.
No, the Rio gaming floor itself is not that big. They have the two main – they've got the what is it, the Masquerade area? Is that what they
call
it?
Yeah, they got the Masquerade area. And
then they've got the, I don't even know what to call the other one, that's kind of outside by the sports book and the restaurants and whatnot by registration.
Yeah, but it's not that
big.
No, it's not that huge. So I don't think anyone's talking about that. I mean, when you talk about casinos and whether there's a saturation point, to me the interesting question becomes, all right, you've got casinos in Atlantic City. Pennsylvania saw all the revenue going to New Jersey and said, well, let me get a piece of that. So you've got casinos in Pennsylvania. Delaware saw revenue going to Pennsylvania and Atlantic City and said, all right, let me get a piece of that. Maryland saw revenue going to Delaware, Atlantic City, and Pennsylvania and said, all right, let me get a piece of that. And I understand where the states are coming from in terms of saying, well, let's keep the revenue at home. The question is whether you hit a saturation point, whether you reach a point where it no longer becomes worth operating the business. And I have to admit, I'm not sure we're at that point yet. And it's one of those things. If you take a look at 5 years ago, go back to 2006, 2007, Atlantic City was, I think, $5 billion casino market. Now, if you take a look at Pennsylvania, Atlantic City, and Delaware in just that region, you're not even including Maryland at this point. You're up to a $6.5-7 billion. This is just on gaming revenue. This doesn't include hotel fees. It doesn't include hotel money. Doesn't include restaurant money. It doesn't include any of that ancillary stuff that comes in when you build a casino resort. And so, have we hit a market saturation point? No, I don't think so. I think this is actually a pretty convenient argument that are used by different types of people. One is casino executives who don't want to see competition coming in. They want all the money for themselves. They're acting like monopolists because they've been monopolists for a long time. They don't want to increase competition. You think Detroit really wants Toledo to open up casinos down there? No, not really. It's an hour away. The people that have been driving up from Toledo to Detroit to go to the Detroit casinos are probably going to stay in Toledo now. It is interesting that Toledo casinos are non-smoking. The Ohio casinos are non-smoking, especially the one in Toledo, and the Detroit casinos allow smoking. So it'll be interesting to see how that affects the revenue and whether that makes a play at all. But we'll see what happens there. But the reason is they want to keep the revenue at home. And they want all the revenue to themselves. But competition is good for the consumer. And more choices you have, the better it is for the consumer. So as far as I'm concerned, build them. Build them more. Give me more choices. And let competition decide rather than a bunch of casino executives saying, no, that's one casino too many. So you've got that in place. Well, the second group of casinos, group of people that are saying, you want to know what, maybe we've reached the saturation point, are people that don't like casinos. And they're like, we already have plenty of casinos. What do we need one more from? Well, these are people that didn't like casinos to begin with. The saturation argument is a handy argument for them to be against casinos without really being anti-gambling. And so you've got that set of problem. And then you've got the third set of people for whom they look at the market, it's like, yeah, we've got something down in Foxwood that's an hour away. We've got something, you know, over here that's an hour away. Do we really need another one? And they worry about things like traffic and that sort of thing. And to me, that's an education issue. It's like, yeah, you want to know what? It's no different than building a new mall. You wouldn't be up against a new mall. You wouldn't be up against a new factory being built. So why should it matter if a new casino is being built? And so those are sort of the three categories. But do I think we're at a saturation point? No, I don't even think we're close to a saturation point. I think there's huge untapped markets there, and that there's pent-up demand there. And as long as there's pent-up demand, you might as well keep building.
You know, I wish I had the presentation that was given at the New England Gaming Summit a couple of years ago by the Mohegan Sun CEO, and it was all about where revenue comes from for casino gambling generally, and then also for Mohegan Sun. And he talked about how much of it is local, how much of it is regional, and how much of it is outside of regional. And, you know, it was amazing how much of it was local. And so if you've got people who, and by local, it was under 100 miles. 100 miles is not, a 90-mile drive isn't really local for most people. I wouldn't consider going to, I would, if I went to a grocery store 90 miles away, I would not consider that a local grocery store. But that was the case for casino gambling because there aren't that many casinos that are, you know, that you can say are local, regional, et cetera. But,
yep.
But so local was less than local was either less than 50 or less than 100. Regional was 250 or less. And anything beyond 250 miles was considered to be beyond regional. And you know, 80 to 90% of the revenue came from regional visitors. Only you know, 10-15% of it came from people outside of 250 miles. And a surprising amount of it came from people that were quote unquote local. Now, and I think Boston fits in, a big part of the Boston metropolitan area fits into that local definition. So that makes a big difference. But if you give people more local options, they'll find a way to get there.
Yeah, and the other thing is casinos are competing for entertainment dollars. They're not competing for gambling dollars. And the funny thing is casinos make that point when they're entering the market and when they talk to legislators and they talk to cities and town councils and they try to explain what's going on. They're very clear about how they're competing for entertainment dollars and not competing for gambling dollars. Yet all of a sudden casino executives are like, oh, wait a minute, too much gambling in the area. Let's keep this casino out. It's like, wait a minute, I thought you were competing for entertainment dollars, not for gambling dollars. Come on now. You can't have it both ways. And look, for Fox was a Mohegan Sun. Mohegan Sun gets about 20% of its traffic from Massachusetts. Foxwoods gets a higher percentage. They get about 30%. And so there's no doubt that their traffic is going to be hurt some by the opening.
They also have the non-smoking sort of – they allow smoking, whereas Massachusetts casinos, when they open, will not.
Yeah, and so yes, they will be hurt some by the opening of casinos in Massachusetts. The expectation is the Detroit casinos will lose about 5% of their revenue when the Ohio casinos open up. It doesn't sound like much, but that's a fair chunk of money. And so yes, in that sense, there's going to be some leakage from existing casinos. But if you take a look at what the Ohio casino revenue is going to be, and then what the Detroit casino revenue is going to be, you add those two numbers up, it's going to be bigger than the existing revenue pie than it is
exactly.
Right now.
Yes.
And that's the same thing about gambling on the East Coast. If you take a look at when all these new casinos open up in Maryland and in Pennsylvania, and you have Revel opening up in Atlantic City, and you've got table games coming to Delaware, that total gaming revenue is going to be up compared to last year when you combine the regions.
Right. Even though New Jersey saw a slide, the total Mid-Atlantic like sort of gambling take, the gross gaming revenue has gone way up.
It's gone way up. So it's not saturated. Now, does that mean Atlantic City hasn't been hurt? No, it's been crushed. It's been hurt a lot. But Atlantic City was hurt a lot, not by market saturation. Atlantic City was hurt by the fact that they weren't competitive. They were hurt by the fact that for years they tried to bus in seniors instead of building up a resort destination. That's what they were hurt by. They were hurt by bad business decisions. And if they positioned themselves properly in the first place, they would have seen their revenue numbers going up and not being crushed. And so, yeah, they would have been hit on the gaming revenue, but they would have made it up in other places. And that's Atlantic City's problem. And so that's the way you have to look at this as a total business problem. And that's why I'm not buying the saturation market problem. I mean, we joke about the Starbucks in every corner, but it's true. And at some point, Starbucks realized that it had to close some stores. And it did that. I don't think the casino industry is at that point where they're looking as like, oh, we got to close a few of these casinos. But when you see the casino industry closing a couple of casinos, then you'll say, yeah, there was a saturation issue. And until you see that, no, there's no saturation issue. All right. Best bets. Did I miss anything, Aaron?
We were going to discuss briefly the World Series of Poker bathroom situation.
Oh, yes, the potty discussion. Aaron, take us home.
Well, there was apparently some controversy. We're hearing all this secondhand because we are not at the World Series of Poker yet.
We
but,
will be there, but
we
we're
will
not
be
there
now. At the starting at the end of June. But apparently there was some controversy. The World Series of Poker got underway officially with the first open event on Memorial Day on Monday. And there was some controversy as there were two bathrooms near the Amazon room that have traditionally been one male, one female, and they had changed
because
that.
Bathrooms usually come in pairs.
Well, yeah, Yes, and usually there is one men's room and one women's room.
One women's room, yes.
But they changed one of them into a men the women's room into a men's room, which there are six total bathrooms in the convention center area at the Rio, and there are two that are very close to the Amazon room, and then there are two kind of between the poker kitchen and the Miranda ballroom, which there are now games going on in the Brasilia. So there's games going on in the Brasilia, and then there are two that are kind of way out, a decent walk from the tournament area.
At the entrance to the convention
center.
And the two bathrooms that should be known, they're near the Brasilia room, those are tiny. How many spaces to be utilized? They probably have about five or six stalls.
Okay, and the ones near the Amazon room, I think there's probably about 10 or 12 stalls.
A dozen stalls and probably
I think there's only maybe 8 to 10 urinals there, correct?
No, I think there are more.
Okay, well, anyway.
Dozen urinals, dozen stalls.
Approximately. So they changed the women's room.
We know way too much about the Rio bathrooms, by the way. All right, understand that this is because we've spent so much time at the Rio, we know exactly which bathrooms to go to, which ones to avoid, and you know when to go and all of that sort of stuff.
If you want to know more about when to go, if you're going for the first time, there's a top 10 list that I wrote for this week's Casino City Times newsletter. You can find that at CasinoCityTimes.com. Anyway,
that is the type of fine, detailed reporting you can expect from the Casino City Times stuff.
So anyway, they changed the women's room into a men's room, and the women were none too pleased. And I can't say that, if I were them, I probably wouldn't have been too pleased either, because they now faced a much longer walk to get to the nearest bathroom. But the one thing is, if you've got a 2,000-player field in a tournament, and historically approximately 3% of those tournaments have been women, so you've got 97-3, and there's a 20-minute break. And you've got 1,940 people, 40 men, lining up for use of one bathroom, and 60 women lining up for use of that same bathroom. I don't think it's unreasonable to say the two main bathrooms we're going to use is men. The women have two more bathrooms, which are a slightly longer walk. However, it's still going to take you less time to walk all the way to that little bit further bathroom and have all 60 women use that bathroom than it is for the two 1,000 or 970 person lines of men to get through those two bathrooms. So Vanessa Self said the suggestion that they should. She said she understands that it makes sense on these days when they have like a day one of a huge $1,500 or $1,000 no limit event to have that bathroom be changed to a men's room, and then on the other days have it be switched to a men's and a women's. And I actually think that makes sense. I can get behind that. But in the end, they ended up reversing the decision. They were facing a big backlash from the women. And let's be fair, it's not just women who play. There's a lot of women in the tournament area that are not playing. They're members of the media. You've got
dealers, cocktail waitresses.
Staff don't use those bathrooms.
Oh, yeah, they do.
Do they?
Yes, they do.
Okay, I've never seen them in there. I thought they had their own, like, because they always go back to some, like, back
room.
No,
but they use
those
restrooms,
like, private lounge area and things like that. All right, so there's that. And then there's also, massage therapists. And so it's not a 97-3 equation. It's probably more like a 92-8, 90-10, somewhere in that range situation when you factor in all the support staff and media, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the time when those bathrooms really get crushed is the breaks. And so I can sympathize with the women, but at the same time, I think changing it for the men's events makes the big $1,500 or $1,000 no limit hold'em events makes a lot of sense. That said, when you change things, it can get confusing, as Barry Greenstein found out by walking into what he thought was a men's room and discovering
he
was mistaken. I don't know. That's what he said on Twitter.
He was, yeah, because I believe everything that's said on Twitter. He was joking.
Hey, everything that's said on Twitter is clue. It's true. Earlier this week, some rapper who I'd never heard of, a 25-year-old rapper named Drake, said the first million is the hardest, and T. Boone Pickens replied, the first billion is a hell of a lot harder. I believe T. Boone Pickens.
Yes.
So anyway, that's bathroom gate, and it apparently is resolved there from the for the remainder of the summer. The Amazon room bathrooms will be men and women. They'll be the other option is just to do a co-ed bathroom.
Because that'll go over well.
Hey, you know, we had a co-ed bathroom in my college dorm, and it went over fine. Well, you know, the men are using urinals, and the women are using the stalls. They've got to, you know, they can shut the door. I'm going to get hate mail like crazy now, I'm sure. But, no, I mean, I don't know.
This is one of those things where...
Have an optional co-ed bathroom.
It's just a recipe for disaster. Just a recipe for disaster, and the interesting Vanessa Selps made an interesting point, and I think some of the other women who played at the World Series of Poker made an interesting point is one of the goals of poker in the World Series of Poker is to encourage more women to participate, and keeping a bathroom close to the main action is helpful in reaching that goal.
Maybe just during breaks it's a men's room. And you have someone out there that has to regulate it, which is a pain. But they say, you know, during breaks this is a men's room.
And as she noted, so like, look, it is easier for men to race out to the bathroom while play is going on and not miss a hand than it is for women. Biology. Yeah, Aaron is just
nodding. I'm
not going
to argue with you here because I'm going to get enough hate mail on that. So, and I'm not going to disagree with you. You're certainly correct.
There's a biologics factor in here. And so, yes, there you've got that too. And so I think ultimately for a variety of reasons, I think from a pure math standpoint, I can see your point. And since most poker players are now math obsessed, they probably all agree with you. At least men do. when you throw in a variety of other factors, I just think it makes sense to keep that as a women's bathroom. And the bottom line is that if the line to the main bathroom is big and the line to the second bathroom is big, go down to the line to the third bathroom at the beginning of the convention thing. You're probably going to get in and out of there faster than you would standing in line for any of the other two bathrooms. It's really odd that people are willing to stand in line uncomfortably but not willing to walk 10 minutes.
It's four to five minutes max.
They're not willing to walk 4 to 5 minutes to an uncrowded restroom, use that and walk back and be in their seat while everyone else is still dancing in line. I just don't understand that. And so
the one point I will concede that I think made a lot of sense is I think Jan Fisher said, you know, there's a lot of talk about how are we going to make poker more welcoming for women and try to bring more women in, and then you do this. This is a way to make it less welcoming for women, and I can understand and agree with that point 100%.
Yes, and then that's what I was trying to get at earlier. All right, that ends the potty talk. on to best bets. Aaron, how did you do last week? Refresh us on what you bet on and how did you do?
Last week I picked three Major League Baseball first inning bets. I picked Detroit to be winning over Cleveland after the first inning. Cleveland had actually won the first inning 1-0, so I lost that bet. I picked the Giants to be beating the Marlins. Beating the Marlins after the first inning. That was a tie, 0-0, so I lost that bet. But I did win a tie bet. I picked San Diego and Mets and the New York Mets. I said they would be tied at 10-13. So I did win that one. I was one and two. Not great. But this week I'm going to pick a golf 18-hole bet. This is at the Memorial. Ernie Els at Bet365 is paired up with Jeff Ogilvie. Els has gotten back into the mix after falling off the face of the earth a few years ago. He's got six top 25 finishes in 11 events this year. Three of them were top 10s, and he just finished second at the Zurich Classic in New Orleans about a month ago. Ogilvie, who is almost 10 years younger, has been consistent this year. He's got six top 25s in 12 events, but he really hasn't broken through with a top-flight performance this year. He doesn't have any top 10s. And Els has the edge in driving. He outdrives Ogilvie by about 8-10 yards. And I think that's going to be important on this course. So I'm going to take Els at minus 110 to post a better score in the first round at the Memorial over Jeff Ogilvie. My next bet, I didn't do fare so well in the first inning bets last week, so I'm going to take a three inning bet today. Detroit at Boston. There's only three Major League Baseball games on the board, so there's not a whole lot to pick from. But in this game, Max Scherzer, and tell me if I'm pronouncing his name incorrectly.
Max Scherzer is correct.
And he's also really struggling this season. It didn't start well. He had a two and two-thirds inning outing in his season debut against the Red Sox. He allowed seven runs in that game.
Well, the Tigers didn't play well in general against the Red Sox.
And, he's had a couple decent outings lately. He's lowered his ERA to 5.67. It's not a good sign when you say you've lowered your ERA to 5.67. But those outings were against some pretty awful teams, and the Pirates and the Twins. I just don't think he's a top-flight pitcher. Whereas Josh Beckett, who had some really bad early season struggles, has been very solid in his last three outings. He's gone at least seven innings in the last three. He's struck out 19, allowed just four walks. He's allowed just three runs, and he's got a 1.24 ERA in that span.
This game's in Detroit?
No, it's in Boston.
Oh, they're still in town. I didn't realize that.
I'm sure there are plenty of good seats available, Vin, if you want to get down there. Or you can come to the Todd Tavern. Anyway, he's been pretty solid, and the Red Sox seem to have, despite all their injuries, they seem to have been finding some answers. Daniel Nava has been pretty solid in their leadoff spot. The offense is really starting to get going, so I'm going to take the Sox to be winning by two or more. Sox at -1.5 through three innings at +205. So, value bet there. It's just a little bit of a stretch. Three innings to have a two run or more lead is kind of a stretch, but because you're getting paid it better than 2-1, I'm going to take it. And finally, I'm going to take a prop bet in that same game. First home run of the game, you can get the solo home run at +115, a two-run home run at +210, a three-run home run at +600, or a grand slam at +4,000. I'm going to take the three-run home run at +600.
All right. No, I did not have any best bets last week, unless you counted me going against Aaron and every one of his bets as my best bets. And my soccer bets start next week, where I will be wagering on Euro 2012 and U.S. World Cup qualifying. At least you get the USA World Cup qualifying, Aaron. Come on, you can't complain about that.
I'm not going to complain about it. I'm just not going to know anything about it.
It's quality wagering.
Nor will I watch a minute of it.
Oh, you're killing me. But we're going hockey today. We're going three prop bets in hockey today. It's going to be fun. And I'm looking forward to the game. Now, the LA Kings, New Jersey Devils, played last night. The Kings won in overtime. 2-1 was the final, I believe. It was a good hockey game. Now, I got to admit, it was tough because I was juggling. I was watching USA-Brazil, the soccer. I was watching the Celtics Heat, and I was watching the hockey game at the same time. So my clicker got a bit of a workout yesterday, but it was a good hockey game. I think this is going to be a good, fun, exciting series. The LA Kings have been fantastic. They won one series in five games. They won their other two in four, and now they're 1-0 against the Devils. So they've only lost one game the entire playoffs. This is San Antonio Spurs-esque. This is a similar sort of run, and the Kings have been fantastic. And so there was a lot of rust, though. The NHL playoffs did something weird. Both teams finished up their series relatively early, and there was all this time off because they were scheduled in padding time in case the series went extra games and that sort of thing. And it's a shame because the series finished early, they were both off for a while, and they had to scrape a little bit of the rust off as they were playing for the first time. I think for the Kings, it was more than a week since they played their last game. But the Kings won 2-1 last night, and I think game two is going to be – you're going to see more goals. I think the teams have gotten used to each other. They felt each other out. They understand what's going on the ice. I think you're going to see more goals. So – with that said, we've got the over-under at 4.5. I'm taking the over. Over pays at 20-23. It's really odd. A lot of people are going to take the under and pay at 20-21. I can see why, especially after 2-1 game, but I like the over at 20-23. So we'll go with that. Time of first score, they've got before 9 minutes 30 seconds, 1-1 after 9 minutes and 30 seconds, 5-7. I'll take the even money. You get a prop bet at even money, I'll take that. So I'll take 9 minutes and 30 seconds. I'll take that before. So I think there's going to be goals scored early in the game, game two, and then the LA Kings 31-20 in the race to three goals. I think the Kings will win the race to three goals. I'll take them at 31-20, and this is going to be fun. I'm looking forward to this game. The final bet, and I am doing four best bets, but the highest scoring period, I'm going to take the second period, and I'm going to go with 6-4. You get the third period at 8-5, and the first period at 21-10. I'm going to go with 6-4 on the second period. So there you have it, my best bets, all in one hockey game. We'll see what happens.
Before we close the show, I do want to give one shout-out to what I think is the most creative World Series of Poker coverage I've seen so far. It's called ShuffleUpInventi.com. I don't even know who this gentleman is, but he is covering the World Series from the Starbucks in the Rio, just outside the convention center.
I like the way you assume it's a man. Could it be a woman?
Well, he's mentioned his wife on several occasions.
It could still be a woman.
It could be a woman. You're correct, but I'm almost certain it's a man.
Who won't be standing in line to go to the bathroom.
It's outstanding. I highly recommend it. Give it a read. It's very well done. I go there every day to find out. They have hilarious like MS Paint drawings. It's a very good way to rail the WSOP from afar.
All right. That does it for this week's edition of the Casino City Gang. We thank you for joining us. You can find out everything you want to know about all the stories we talked about in today's shows at CasinoCityTimes.com and online.CasinoCity.com. You can also download the podcast from our family of websites there. You can download it from BlogTalkRadio.com/Spartion. And we will see you next week. And if you are betting, try to pick the right side. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Please follow all local, state, and federal laws regarding gambling in your jurisdiction. The music for this podcast is provided by the PodSafe Music Network.